Wednesday about how that if you go through history, we really start to see that in really the last 200 years or so is when we really start to see Christianity fracture. I guess 400 years, I should say. And we just noticed how that there was that big split there. We talked about some things that as America was being settled, that there were some unique things that really kind of led to the Restoration Movement. We talked about that the number of groups that was continuing to separate from the Catholic Church and the Church of England, and just how quickly things were splintering, and that there were going to be a lot of people who were not very happy with that. We did talk about the difference between the Restoration and the Reformation, mostly being they had the same goals, but the difference was, where do I want to go back to? Where the Reformation wanted to reform the Catholic Church to what it was prior to some of the corruption that the people of its time saw, that the Restoration was saying that wasn't far enough. We need to go back to a previous time, go back to primitive Christianity here. And we did talk about this idea that the difference between those is that once we become unfaithful, you have three options. Either you don't change, in which case you don't remain God's church. You either return back to where you were, or if things are so bad, you have to restart. And that's really the difference between the Reformation and the Restoration there. We talked about how that just like with the Reformation movement, there were some causes of the Reformation, that there was a resurgence in the circulation of the Bible. The cost of the Bible started to drop dramatically. There was a change in the shift of churches being from primarily in the cities to shifting to being the majority of the congregations were now rural congregations. Many people felt that the Reformation had been carried too far and was continuing to do that as groups were splitting. The Reformation groups started looking more like what they had tried to reform. They were becoming more ritualistic. They were starting to continue to have some of the structure and the priesthood and the corruption that was seen that they were said they were trying to leave. And of course, one of the big ones, which we will see today was a big deal, was that the ability for smaller groups or even for individuals to be able to publish material and to get that distributed more widely was a big deal there. Some of the principles of the Restoration that maintain across these guys that we're going to talk about today. Jesus is the one and only head of the church. There is not a human head of the church who can change things or make rules for that. The New Testament is the only rule of faith and practice. No creeds or documents or traditions or histories that would make difference. The local congregation is autonomous, can make decisions for itself. Does not need a structure that would go up because the New Testament contains the only structure needed. Specifically, the use of titles and names was particularly offensive to some of these guys. So the idea of reverend or father or some of the other titles that had been come up with, archbishop and diocese and some of those different words were problems for them. Unity of believers is a big thing. We'll see that toward the end of the day. The belief that God's gospel is libertarian in nature, meaning it's a message of freedom, not a message of restriction. And, of course, that Christianity is primarily individual in nature. And then we did talk about a few people, some of the early reformers on Wednesday. But for the most part, today, we are going to spend the rest of our time talking about four different people. Two guys from the same family, Thomas Campbell and Alexander Campbell, his son. We'll be talking about them and their role and then how their separate works, all three merged and kind of came together there in 1832 and what happened a little bit after that is what we'll cover today. So the first guy we're going to talk about, even he's not the oldest guy on this list, the first guy we're going to talk about is Barton W. Stone, and some of you have probably studied this quite extensively, more so than I have. I'll tell you the 10, maybe the 10 to 20 hours or so between this time and the last time I taught this material that I've studied this. I've only scratched the surface of the material out there, And quite honestly, the bigger change is how do you distill this down into 45 minutes. But I also will say that before we start talking about these guys in too much detail, we're going to talk about them from the history and what they did and some of their characteristics, but that doesn't mean that necessarily we would hold these guys as any more or less important than someone else, although you cannot deny the impact that some of these guys would have, specifically on this congregation being here in Kentucky and some of the roots that they would have started here. Okay? So Barton Stone was born December 24th, 1772. He passed away November 9th, 1844, at the age of 71. When we talk about his religious background, his mother was born into and maintained a very faithful member of the Church of England. His father was not very religious one way or the other. And whenever his father died, and for financial reasons, she moved the family. She later switched to leave the Church of England and became part of a Methodist congregation. So that is really kind of more of the environment that Barton was raised in, was that Methodist church. However, he was not very religious at all and pretty much didn't go to church with his mother even. It wasn't until he was in his 20s and was at college that he ran into some people that really encouraged him and that he really started following. He studied, previously to that, some of the beliefs of the Methodist, the Baptist, and the Episcopalian churches, but discarded them all because they were primarily the Calvinistic teachings. He really had some trouble with early, but he met some very influential Presbyterian preachers when he was at college and eventually joined with the Presbyterian church. So even though he joined with the Presbyterian church there, he still struggled with many of their teachings. However, he felt that they were the closest from everything that he had studied. So he did, in 1798, become a Presbyterian minister, officially ordained by the Presbyterian Church. And at his ordaining ceremony, one of the things that they ask is if you believe in the Presbyterian Confession of Faith, it's called, specifically the Westminster Confession of Faith. And so the question was posted to him: do you receive and adopt the Confession of Faith as concerning the system of doctrine as taught in the Bible? And he said, I do, as far as I see it consistent with the Word of God. So already he is starting to kind of hedge his bets within the Presbyterian Church and letting them know that he is going to be more Bible-based than he would be based on any kind of creeds or things like that. He then moved from the New England area to Cane Ridge, Kentucky, which is near modern Concord, Kentucky. He continued to question many of the teachings. Primarily, he had issues with the Presbyterians' view of the Trinity, and a lot of his writings would talk about that. He had a lot of problem with the idea of predestination and limited unconditional election, and of course the idea of a total depravity and infant baptism were things that he had problems with also. One of the things that he was pretty famous for saying about that predestination and limited unconditional election is where, you know, for God so loved the whole world, but how come he only picked a few? It was one of his famous sayings there about that. So we really do start to see him then split with the Presbyterian Church. In 1801, this is the right in between the first and the starting of the Second Great Awakenings, which were some names that have been given to some movements in the United States to have the big tent revivals and things like that that went on in this time period. So the Cane Ridge Revival was one of the largest. It's been posted that it was attended over the week long by over 20,000 people. Very few people believe that any more than 10,000 at one time could have been present, but still, that was one-tenth the entire state population at the time. So one-tenth of all the people in Kentucky made it to this revival. And for the first time, Barton, being the one who primarily put this together as the minister of the Cane Ridge congregation, he broke out and invited speakers from the Methodist Church and the Baptist Church that were close by, and so they had over 18 preachers from three different faiths who all preached there, and he really pressed that you could come speak as long as your focus was on unity and on that we're getting back towards Christians, just being that way. And really, he believed and pressed in this revival that the only differences that should matter to us are that we are a Christian or not, and that all these other differences should be put aside and that those challenges could be overcome. His message that time, which really got a lot of people mad, was, as I messaged there, he really preached about God loving the whole world and how it was the mission of God's Son was here to save the lost, not those who had been chosen, but that man must believe, repent, and obey the gospel in order to be saved from sin. As you can imagine, that didn't go over so well with some of the Presbyterian leadership because he directly taught against many of the Calvinistic tenets. So Stone and five others leave the Presbyterian organization to, in 1803, start what was called the Springfield Presbytery. It doesn't last very long. The group was troubled themselves with splitting off to form another church, but yet they had been kind of excommunicated or they were put out from the main Presbyterian body because of their teaching. So it didn't last very long, less than a year. And in 1804, the Springfield Presbytery dissolves. And the only reason that this is really relevant historically is as part of this disillusion of this group, they wrote, Barton primarily penned and the other five guys signed, what was called the Last Will and Testament of the Springfield Presbytery. What it then did was really lay forward, we're dissolving this group, and one of the founding statements was that it will just dissolve into the greater body of God's church. And they laid out a lot of things that they wanted to see happen. Specifically, some of them were to stop using words like reverend, which all six of these guys were considered reverends previous to this. They said, we'll stop using those terms. They believed that there should be no church law that would set about discipline or how you get into the church or requirements, anything found outside the Bible. They talk specifically in this document about congregational autonomy and how that no group like the Springfield Presbytery should exist and how it should not control other congregations. And of course, that they should use the Bible only. No other creed or teaching should be used. Okay, so they start this movement here, which they call themselves Christians. However, the name Christian Church kind of tends to become used to describe them, even though some of their early buildings and things like that, they didn't put any sign up. They would just say, we're Christians, and that's all that they would say. However, of course, this causes some challenges. So some, especially some of that original six, decide to return to the Presbyterian Church. They denounce Stone and some of his teachings in order to get back in. And so Stone and some of these others formed these Christian groups, which, as I mentioned, came to be called the Christian Church. So Stone and some others refused that name of the Christian Church, keeping that term only Christians. In 1810, you may remember we talked about on Wednesday the works of Elias Smith and James O'Kelly. A lot of those groups started getting together and really forming that idea that we are a group of Christians only. There was no central organization, just a loose connection of a couple congregations existing primarily in this area. And so there were approximately 10,000 people who would have been part of this group of people centered in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio, where most of those people were. Just some other quick facts about Barton Stone. In 1819, he moved to modern-day Georgetown, Kentucky, to become the president of what was called Rittenhouse Academy at the time. Was later, just a few years later, renamed as Georgetown College, still exists today, and is pretty famous here in Kentucky. And so he was the first president of that. In 1834, he moved from Kentucky to Jackson, Illinois because of slavery. His wife's family in particular was very wealthy, and she had inherited from her mother-in-law a quite substantial number of slaves, including children. And the way that her will was set up, the mother-in-law's will, was it was in Kentucky, and the way the will was set up is that those slaves were bequeathed to her and to her children forever, and that she could not give them up in the state of Kentucky. It was illegal. They were controlled by a trust to make sure that she couldn't pass them on to anyone else. So they moved to Illinois, which was a northern state, a free state for slavery, where they could legally free the slaves that they had inherited from his mother-in-law. Kind of an interesting little tidbit there. Another guy we're going to talk about here. So now we're going to switch to the Campbell family. So Thomas Campbell, of course, is the first one we're going to talk about. He was born February 1st in 1763, died January 4th, 1854, at the age of 90. A little bit of background about him. He was born in a county down Ireland. Almost all of these guys have Irish descent, most of them even going farther back a little bit to some of my shared background in Scotland there. And the enlightening that was happening in Ireland at the time, it really influenced almost all these guys. But he was definitely born there. He was highly educated, both as a school secular teacher and also as a minister. He was raised in the Anglican Church, or the Church of England, means the same thing, but was ordained as in the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. During college, he went to Glasgow, which our city right up the highway is named after. He went to Glasgow College, and there really started studying under Presbyterian teachers and became ordained in the Presbyterian Church instead of the Anglican Church. Of course, that has something to do with the whole Irish-English trouble that was going on at the time, too. However, he gets very sick. He becomes very ill with some stomach issues. We don't know what they are today, but I'm sure modern medicine would give him something other than the idea, we'll go to America, that'll fix your stomach. I don't understand why, but the doctor told him to go to America. So he did. He left his entire family. Actually, there's a whole story about he went on one boat, and the rest of his family was supposed to come on another, but that boat actually got shipwrecked and landed right back in Scotland, and they didn't come for another couple of years, the rest of his family. It's also interesting that he developed many of his ideas while he was here in the U.S., but yet his son Alexander, who is the more famous of the two, was still in Ireland because it took him another couple of years to get here. It's kind of interesting when they joined back together that they had formed some of the same ideas separately. Remember, it's not like today, right? Just because you left, we still talk every night, and I mean, we can video chat every night with people no matter where they are in the world, right? It wasn't like that then, okay? He had, of course, a lot of problems with the Presbyterian Church also, primarily around Calvinism and all the things that it brings with it. The continued contentions and splitting within the Presbyterian group, especially in Ireland, there was a lot of splitting and infighting within the Presbyterian Church at the time. He really, really was troubled by that. The teaching of the Presbyterian Church that required that you study and understand some of the creeds and statements of their faith over the Bible, he didn't really like that. So when he came to the U.S., he started to really preach for the first time this stricture of Bible only. Quickly has his credentials as a Presbyterian minister stripped from him. He's not allowed to speak in Presbyterian churches anymore. However, he continues teaching house to house. Many of the people that he had been serving as a Presbyterian minister, he now goes to their homes to teach them, eventually switches over and starts to work with some Baptist groups, as he had already begun to believe that baptism was by immersion as opposed to sprinkling, which was the predominant method of the time in the Presbyterian Church. He is one of the guys who really laid down some of the foundational ideas, specifically one that I know you've heard, the foundational statement of the restoration. He is the one who started the phrase, to speak where scriptures speak, be silent where scriptures are silent. Specifically, he said, where the scriptures speak, we speak, and where the scriptures are silent, we are silent. That phrase, of course, really took off and became a big part of the Restoration Movement. He made this as the final closing statement of a speech in 1809. The story goes that the entire room was completely silent for almost 5 full minutes as that really sunk in to the people he was speaking about, because this was a radical new idea to use only the Bible. So finally someone responded, and this is a recounting of the event that I read here. So one of the guys in the audience finally spoke up and said, Mr. Campbell, if we adopt that as a basis, then there is an end of infant baptism, which Thomas still believed in, by the way. Just he believed it was by immersion, not sprinkling. And Thomas's reply then was, well, if infant baptism is not found in Scripture, we can have nothing to do with it. One of the pretty famous encounter there. And of course, that phrase got carried all the way down. I'm going to shift quickly to talk about his son, Alexander Campbell, who is by far the most well-known of the two. He was born September 12, 1788, died at the age of 77, March 4, 1866. Some background, he was born in Ireland. He was homeschooled by his father until he went to Glasgow College. Remember, his father was trained as an educator. So he went straight to Glasgow College, the same place his father had gone. He comes to America in 1809, 2 years later, with his mother and the rest of the family. And they join with his father then in Virginia area and begin to prepare. He decides that he wants to become a preacher. He's very excited by some of the things that his father is talking to him about, because he was coming to some of those same conclusions while he was in college back in Ireland. So, as far as his preparation to become a preacher, his father really encourages him to study only the Bible and the Bible only, but Alexander decides to go a little bit farther. So he's 21 at this time, and he decides that he is going to dedicate at a minimum 10 hours per day of scheduled study in order to prepare himself for the work of being a preacher, of which he's going to dedicate 1 hour every day to studying Greek, 1 hour every day to studying Latin, 1 hour every day to study Hebrew, 2 hours every day to memorize 10 verses. Often, though, he would memorize entire chapters. So when he would spend 2 hours a day memorizing, he would memorize an entire chapter. Said that he had the entire New Testament memorized. And then 5 hours per day studying and reading various topics. He does this for a little bit over a year, and on July 15th, 1810, he delivers his first sermon based on the Sermon on the Mount. Okay. Then he's married, of course. He gets married during this time to actually a very wealthy family locally there in the Virginia area. And I'm sorry, this gets a little bit small. I didn't realize it was getting that small on the screen. But on March 13th of 1812, his daughter Jane is born. This really causes him to study the practice of infant baptism. There's pressure from the local Baptist church to baptize his daughter with sprinkling. And so as part of that, he really digs into the study of baptism and comes to several conclusions there then. Based on scriptures, he comes to the conclusion that infant baptism was a human invention, not something that was found in scripture. Even though, this is kind of a side note, we do know that infant baptism was occurring as early as 250 AD, so it was a very early on idea, but yet he comes to the conclusion that it's not found in the Bible, that true baptism is only through immersion, the burying of the body in water as that symbolic of the death, that only a repentant believer should be baptized. The only confession or statement needed to be baptized was a confession of faith in Jesus as God's Son, no other confession of any other creed or human statement. And he also came to the conclusion that he was not properly baptized because he had been baptized as an infant and therefore was not in agreement with Christ's covenant. He immediately ran to his father and started discussing this with him. So, June. So 3 months later, almost to the day, June 12th of 1812, the entire family is baptized. Alexander and his wife Margaret, Thomas and Jane, the father and mother, and then his sister, Dorothea, are all baptized there. They get a Baptist preacher, an elder of one of the Baptist congregations, to come and baptize them. He doesn't like it because he believes that their baptism was sufficient when they were babies. Within the family then, let's see how we're doing on time. So within the family now, Alexander starts to take the lead. Even though he's only 24, he really starts to take the lead over his father. His father is supporting him. They are still working within the Baptist church. They found what is called the Brush Run Baptist Church, which is part of the Redstone Association of Washington. However, things start to change. In 1816, there's a famous story. Alexander is at a lectureship of the Baptist church, the Redstone Association, and the guy who was supposed to speak that morning became violently ill, so they had no one to speak. He decided to step up, and he delivered what has been called the Sermon on Law, where he focused on the Old Testament and New Testament differences, and then specifically teaching that no other human creed or dogma besides the Bible should be used. He's doing this at a Baptist conference where they're discussing these other dogmas or creeds, and so it did not go over very well at all. In fact, it really kind of starts the downfall or the split here. Man, this got small again. I'm sorry. So they start to leave the Baptist church. In 1818, Alexander starts what he calls the Buffalo Seminary, which is in his home along Buffalo Creek. It's actually the place where his family had been baptized there. So teaching young men to become preachers, but in his home, he starts to teach things against many Baptist doctrines. In 1823, he begins publishing the Christian Baptist, very much against traditional Baptist beliefs of the time, and he starts to widen the gap, and many start to denounce him, so much so that he has to leave the Redstone Association. The Brush Run congregation is no longer considered part of that. However, there is another group based out of Ohio that accepts them, the Mahonan Association. In 1830, he stops publishing the Christian Baptist and starts the Millennial Harbinger. One of his big differences with the Baptist Church was the viewpoint of the millennial and the end times. And so his group starts to become known as the Disciples of Christ, although almost everybody calls them Campbellites. Disparagingly is a bad nickname. He doesn't like it, and neither do they. They want to be called only disciples. Since he is perhaps the most famous, definitely the most written of these guys, I thought I'd share with you some quotes. So one of the quotes of him: "We will not hearken to those questions which gender strife, nor discuss them at all. If a person says such is his private opinion, we'll let him have it as his private opinion, but lay no stress upon it. And if it be a wrong private opinion, it will die a natural death much sooner than if you attempt to kill it." Don't fight about matters of opinion. He, however, says that he didn't always do that. This is a very famous quote of his. "I was once so strict a separatist that I would neither pray nor sing praises with anyone who was not as perfect as I had supposed myself. In this most unpopular course, I persisted until I discovered the mistake and saw that on the principle embraced in my conduct, there never could be a congregation or church upon this earth." So, kind of mouthy 18th century language there, but basically saying that if he wouldn't pray or sing with anybody who didn't believe exactly as he believed till he decided, well, wait a minute, then there'll never be a church if we have to have that as our standard. Another one, again about opinions. And I just like the last part of this here. "But men cannot give up their opinions, and therefore they can never unite," says one. "We do not ask them to give up their opinions. We ask them only not to impose them upon others. Let them hold their opinions, but let them hold them as private property. The faith is public property. Opinions are and have always been private property. It is cruel to excommunicate a man because of the imbecility of his intellect. I like that statement. What's that? Yeah. Yeah, you probably would, like a lot of the things he said. Okay. Some things that were said about him I found pretty interesting. General Robert E. Lee had this to say about him. He is a man in whom were illustriously combined all the qualities that could adorn or elevate the nature to which he belonged. Knowledge of the most varied and extended, virtue that never loitered in her career nor deviated from her course. A man who, if he had been delegated as a representative of his species to one of the many superior worlds, would have suggested a grand idea of the human race. Pretty high praise. President James Madison said this about him: "It was my pleasure to hear him very often as a preacher of the gospel, and I regard him as the ablest and most original and most powerful expounder of the scriptures I have ever heard." And another president, President Garfield, had this to say of him: "He is a living wonder. When in his company, you feel the shadow of his greatness falling upon you. A new man every time you meet him, for his mind seems to be taking a sweep through the universe and is enlightening new objects at every inch of its orbit. Thus far in his course, systems have been crushed before him, truth has blazed around, and peace and righteousness have followed in his train." Some pretty amazing things some people said about him there. Some interesting facts and some other things about him. He initially avoided public debates, but eventually became the most prolific debater of the Restoration Movement. His debates were extremely famous and widely published. He had 14 children by two wives, 8 children by his first wife, who then passed away. He got remarried and had 6 more. He started Bethany College in 1840, was the first president of Bethany College, which still exists today. A couple presidents actually have gone there, some of the early ones. Published his own translation of the Bible, and published 2 hymnals, one of which I have seen still used today, the Christian Hymn Book, which he labeled Psalms, Hymns, and Spiritual Songs. Would have a lot of the songbooks that we would still have today in it. We got to get going here. The other guy I wanted to talk about who was part of this restoration movement was Raccoon John Smith. There he is. He was born October 5th, 1784, died in 1868 at the age of 84. He was born in Tennessee, had no formal education, taught by his father. The story goes that the school where he went, the headmaster of the school, which at the time was just one person, was a renowned drunk, and so he left school and after only 4 months. He was raised Baptist and sought the Calvinistic calling, as it had been described to him, that you will feel that elect calling, but yet he never received it. So he started reading the Bible and questioning his father's teaching. Later on, in around 1824, he met Alexander Campbell. He'd already been reading what Alexander Campbell had been publishing called The Christian Baptist. Many Baptists were questioning Campbell's election, as you know, they would believe as part of that, at least at the time, that Calvinistic teaching that you are either elected or not, and you will be joined that. So Smith traveled up to Kentucky to hear Campbell. He later moved to Kentucky, becoming one of the most well-known preachers in this state. But after hearing him speak, he was asked if Campbell was one of the elect, if he felt that he was one of the elect and should be listened to, and this was his answer. He said, "I know nothing about the man, but be he saint or devil, he has thrown more light on the Galatian letter and on the whole scriptures than I have received in all the sermons that I have ever heard before." Pretty high praise. Raccoon, that name Raccoon is was given to him because he used to describe that he was born in such a backwoods Tennessee area that his only neighbors were the raccoons. He was a very charismatic speaker and was not ashamed of his lack of education, which was a big deal at the time. If you were not someone who went to college and went to one of these colleges that were sponsored by one of the churches, then you were looked down upon, not able to speak. After speaking to a group of lawyers and judges in Sparta, Tennessee, he was asked if he was embarrassed to preach to such learned men. He said, not in the least, for I have learned that judges and lawyers, so far as the Bible is concerned, are the most ignorant class of people of the world, except doctors of divinity. He talked often about speaking before well-known preachers here in Kentucky. However, he said, and he was not afraid to do that. However, he said, I must confess that the first time I ever preached before Alexander Campbell, I did falter a little bit. And Alexander Campbell had this to say of him and his lack of education when people challenged if John Smith should be allowed to speak. He said, John Smith is the only man that I ever knew who would have been spoiled by a college education. His ability to speak to the common people and to build that repertoire with them was his greatest strength there. So these four guys in three different areas. You had Stone, which was in Ohio and Kentucky, and then you had Raccoon Smith, which was in Tennessee and Kentucky, and then you had the Campbells, which were actually from Pennsylvania down into Virginia. It was before there was a West Virginia. It was just all one into Virginia and then into Kentucky area. You had these three groups basically moving a little bit separate, but they had started to hear about each other. So as far as the Restoration movement itself went, the groups merged. In 1831, Raccoon had met the Campbells and Barton Stone both, Kentucky being that central place where he was really primarily preaching. He noticed the similarities in the goals, despite some of the different backgrounds, and he suggested that the groups should meet and combine. Despite some of their differences in practice and belief, they agreed that unity was important and that some of these could be matters of opinion. Things like, what was the work of the Holy Spirit today? The frequency of the Lord's Supper. Some believed weekly, some did quarterly, some did monthly, some did every day, some of the different groups. The ideas about the Godhead and the Trinity, the exact nature of Jesus, and even the idea of baptism, salvation, and the timing of that. Is baptism something that, you know, you just do, or is baptism part of salvation? They had some differences in those exact little things, but yet they decided that their goals were similar. They all agreed that the church should be united and that we could continue to talk about these things. So in 1832, right here in Kentucky, just up the road in Lexington, Kentucky, they met at the High Street Meeting House. There was what was called a unity meeting that was held there, as in Lexington was one of the few places where there were both disciples of Christ under Campbell, who would have followed Campbell's teaching, and Christians, or the Christian church, that would have followed Stone's teachings. So there were very large congregations there, so they decided to meet in Lexington. Interestingly enough, Alexander Campbell was not there, but at this meeting, very famously, after some things that John Smith said there, which I'll show you in just a minute, John Smith and Barton Stone walk up in front of the entire group, shake hands, and they decide that we're going to merge these two groups into a single network of congregations. Still no central body, but that just these churches would agree that they were working together. Some of the things that were said there, which were pretty interesting, John Smith said, whatever opinions about these and similar subjects I may have reached, those lists that we had earlier, in the course of my investigation, if I never distract the Church of God with them or seek to impose them upon my brethren, they will never do the world any harm. Basically saying, my opinions can be whatever they are as long as I don't try to impose them on someone else. He continued on to say, and there's a bunch of words in here, I'm just picking out some select statements. While there is but one faith, there may be 1,000 opinions. And henceforth, if Christians are ever to be one, they must be one in faith and not in opinion. Then he wrapped up his statement just before the famous handshake with this final sentence. Let us then, my brethren, be no longer Campbellites or Stonites, new lights or old lights, or any other kind of lights, but let all come to the Bible and to the Bible alone as the only book in the world that can give us all the light that we need. That new lights and old lights refers to some things that were happening back, started back in Ireland within the Presbyterian Church. So following that great statement is when they stood up and had that very famous handshake. Still then in 1832, Campbell and Stone would meet later to discuss these differences, and there were plenty of them. But the discussion centered around the love of fellowship and the love for fellow Christians. And John Smith, again, being that very famous and good speaker, was the one who continued to push them together there. So it's decided then that representatives would go to all the congregations to tell them of this merger. And this is where we see the names, some because there was not going to be one central group that was going to tell everybody what to do. They just decided that these congregations would work together. So there was no name to push down. They argued quite a bit about that. So some kept the Disciples of Christ that they were already using. Some kept the Christian Church. And others started using the Church of Christ in what they would call themselves as a group. You can trace the lineage of this congregation directly to that. So continuing that merger then, all of a sudden this name, the Restoration Movement, starts to become popular as the various groups, since there was no common name, since all these congregations had separate names, they started to use this idea of the Restoration or Restored Churches. This group continued to exchange ideas and theology through preaching and publications. It was very common for preachers from one of these groups to travel around, and really this is where we start to see the idea of, even though what we would today call gospel meetings were kind of this revival idea, we start to see that was how these groups kind of kept in sync with each other, since there was no central organization. They just would share preachers. Bear with me for just a few moments and I'll finish up here. So rapid growth happened in the U.S. If you go by census numbers, in 1832, when these two groups merged, there were 22,000. By 1860, there were 192,000. By 1819, 641 and some odd. By 1990, 1,142,353 people identified with this group. However, problems start to creep in. They continue to debate over some of these specifics, things like instrumental music, missionary societies, millennial viewpoints, clergy and ordained ministers, inspiration and infallibility of the scripture. These start to become matters of faith instead of opinion, and so we start to see splits, especially after the death of some of these key leaders. So much so, my last slide, I promise you here, that the formal split was recognized by the government in 1906. And so in the census of 1906, there were two different groups that were counted there. And so you can see the Disciples of Christ and the Churches of Christ. They counted the congregation and the members, so still at that little over that 1 million mark and about 11,000 congregations. However, this has continued to grow throughout the 1900s, so that by the time you get to 2000, just interestingly enough, the Christian Church or Disciples of Christ grows to fewer congregations and fewer members. It goes down a little bit. But the unaffiliated Christian Church or Churches of Christ, 5,200 and 1,004,000. And then we would probably fit into this next group, Churches of Christ, into 12,500 congregations, a little over 1.5 million members. And then the International Churches of Christ, the government links in with this group, 450 congregations and about 120,000 members. So by 2000, I don't have any numbers newer than that, right around 4 million people would be affiliated with this group. All right. Thank you very much for your attention, and Seth will be covering